Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Morning, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Chief Justice Steele, Justice Berger, Justice Holland, Joseph Cicchetti on behalf of the appellant, Roger Wilhelm. Your Honor, this case arises out of a serious car accident that occurred back in May of 2001. The essential facts of the case were stipulated prior to trial. Essentially, the defendant in this case was drunk, was driving north on 202, approximately 80 miles an hour, ran a red light at 141, T-boned a car driven by Cameron Logan, which spun out of control and then hit my client's car, which was stopped southbound on 202. My client then exited the car and approached the Logan vehicle to find Mr. Logan bleeding from a number of places in his body. Unfortunately, Mr. Logan died shortly thereafter in his presence. My client thereafter developed a number of problems associated with his neck, and essentially a year and a half later had neck fusion surgery. He incurred approximately $70,000 in medical bills, and we filed suit in this case. At trial, after a three-day trial, despite the fact that the jury was instructed as a matter of law that my client was injured and had suffered damages in this case, the jury returned a verdict in the amount of $4,108. Now, prior to trial, the defendant in this case, Ms. Ryan, had pled guilty to vehicular homicide. At no point in time was my client or was Ms. Ryan charged with any crimes associated with my client's injuries or anything that was associated with his injuries in this accident. Prior to trial, anticipating her testimony as to her conviction or pleadings, her plea or sentencing or going to jail or anything like that, I filed a motion in limine to preclude that testimony. That was denied by the court in this case, and for a number of reasons, we believe that to be an abuse of discretion. Firstly, Delaware historically has precluded any admission, any testimony with regard to prior criminal convictions or sentences associated with mitigation of
Excuse me just a moment. Make sure I understand the chronology. During your case in chief, you did present evidence of her guilty plea and conviction, is that correct?
I believe the police officer in this case, in response to one of my questions, did say that she was convicted. I don't know that I asked that direct question, but believe that did come out. I didn't elicit any questions associated with her sentencing or anything like that, or anything associated with any feelings of guilt or, you know, her remorse or anything associated with her meeting with the decedent's mother subsequent to that. To the case.
Well, after the police, you made the motion to eliminate that was denied.
Yes.
But after the police officer testified in front of the jury that, you know, she pled guilty, did you approach the bench and say, you know, consistent with your motion, you should exclude that? It was a non-responsive question, or did you just keep going?
No, Your Honor, I did not. I did not. To be with all due candor to the court, I did not. I can't remember exactly why that would have been the case, but at the time, that would have possibly been in anticipation of her testimony that I anticipated coming in subsequently on her case in chief, which did in fact come in.
So in light of the ruling on the motion in limine, you knew her testimony was coming in, and the fact that the police officer might have given you a non-responsive answer wasn't going to be a big deal.
I had to try to mitigate that anticipated testimony as best I could at the time, and that's one of the reasons possibly that I may have not objected to it or it didn't come out, or quite frankly, I may not have, in the heat of a trial, I may not have picked up on it at the time. But clearly, Delaware case law historically has not allowed any testimony with regard to prior criminal convictions to mitigate damages in this case. And even if somehow the testimony associated with her conviction was allowed in and somehow I missed that, any of her testimony associated with, you know, her meeting with Ms. Logan's mother or Mr. Logan's mother, feeling guilty, how long she was in jail, how sorry she was, crying thereafter, had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with my client's case at all. Any of her crime or any of his, any of her crimes, any of the damages associated with
him. How do you respond to the argument from the other side that if you're seeking punishment, and it's fair to testify with regard to punishment that's already been received? And
Well, this isn't a sentencing hearing in the criminal sense. I believe the Jefferson case pointed out by the defendant in this case essentially outlines the public policy associated with punitive damages. These aren't criminal punishment. I believe the Jefferson case indicates that these are different parties. It's not the state versus my client or the defendant in this case. You're talking about breach of the public peace versus private criminal private damages in this case. Punitive damages would be associated with public example from a jury, not with potentially a negotiated plea between the state and the defendant in this case.
I'm not sure I understand the phrase, be associated with public what from the jury?
Public. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You used the phrase which wasn't real clear to me. That it wouldn't be associated with public what from the jury?
Breach of the public peace. I believe that's what the Jefferson case indicates, that convictions and sentencing, that's the purpose of criminal damages, criminal convictions, criminal sentencing, is for a breach of the public peace. I mean, you could have changed the facts in this case just a little bit.
Well, what were the facts that supported a claim for punitive damages that were actually developed in this case that we're now arguing that evidence of a conviction and remorse for the conviction did or didn't affect?
She was traveling 80 miles an hour in a 40 or 35 mile an hour zone on a public road. She was drunk. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. She ran a red light. She killed somebody.
Yeah, all that's true. But what developed your case for punitive damages?
Well, that willful and wanton conduct and the fact that my client was injured, had serious injuries as a result, and he had to witness the death of a minor child or a 17-year-old child that he has to live with for the rest of his life.
Is that the same thing as punitive damages from her?
Well, that arises.
I thought that was the infliction of emotional distress.
Well, I believe in addition to emotional distress, that rises to willful and wanton behavior on her behalf.
Okay, let's assume that's true. Is it in the record what her net worth was in the case where you sought punitive damages?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor, and I don't believe that that's necessary in a claim under Delaware case law for punitive damage, and that was discussed in this case.
Well, how does a jury, if they have a proper claim for punitive damages, assess how much that punitive damages claim should be if they know nothing about the individual's ability to pay or net worth?
Well, that would be up for the jury to decide, and I did research this before the case went to trial, and Delaware
what
doesn't...
What would be up for the jury to decide?
How much punitive damage would be appropriate to punish a defendant.
Well, but how do they decide it if they have no idea that there's a difference between the ability to punish someone, let's say between the DuPont company and the individual defendant in this case? Don't punitive damages relate somehow to you can only punish to the degree it's going to hurt someone when they're punished? And doesn't their net worth have something to do with assessing the amount of punitive damage?
I think it may, but I don't think it's the only dispositive way to go about assessing punitive damages. Certainly when you're talking about a corporation, it would be more relevant to talk about the net worth of the corporation. But I believe under case law here in Delaware, it's not necessary to understand what the net worth of any defendant is in order to impose punitive damages. That's my understanding of the law here in Delaware.
Well, is there a difference between determining that there is a proper claim for punitive damages and assessing the amount of those damages?
I'm sorry?
Is there a distinction between a determination that there is a proper claim pled and proved to establish a right to punitive damages and a distinction between that and what should that appropriate amount be?
I'm sure it may or may not be helpful to a jury to understand what this person is worth in order to establish what an appropriate punitive damage measure might be. But historically, I didn't find anything in the cases that required or it was. I mean,
is there anything in federal case law that requires it?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Within the last 2 years?
Your Honor, I did not, with all due respect, I did not research that issue as far as whether or not that's actually required and whether or not that's jurisprudence in the federal courts.
Do you believe that the case law now establishes that there has to be a rational relationship between the amount of punitive damages awarded and the amount of compensatory damages that same jury finds?
Now that Your Honor brings that up, I believe there was a Supreme Court case in the last few years that did discuss that there has to be a rational relationship, and I believe that is the phraseology. But that rational relationship, I don't know that it's actually necessary. And I believe that case is associated with punishing a corporation. I don't know that it's associated with punishing an individual. And historically here in Delaware, the case law speaks to punishment of an individual. And I believe a jury is quite capable of understanding what a 17-year-old girl it may or may not have. It's one thing to punish a corporation for acts they may or may not have done, and they're worth billions of dollars. It's another to punish.
So Paris Hilton, if she were the defendant in this case, would be punished in the same way as my daughter.
Well, I don't know that Paris Hilton should be distinguished from any other individual as far as what's appropriate. I think what you punish them for is...
How do you punish them if you assess them damages that don't really affect them at all? They just write a check from their personal checking account.
Your Honor, I guess I would tend to agree with you. It might be helpful for a jury to understand exactly what the net worth of a particular person is, but I don't...
Well, the bottom line is, where are we going with this? If we were to conclude that the judge erred by allowing the testimony to which you object and for which you filed your motion in limine, what would be the result? How would this case turn out differently?
Well, Your Honor,
given the record,
I don't know that the actual amount of the punitive damage is really what the issue here is. Is what happened with the introduction of her testimony associated with her feelings and talking about the mother and so forth. It was palpable in the courtroom, the change in the mood of the jury after she got up on the stand. She sat in the courtroom for 3 days, one of which she had a skirt on and a monitoring brace. She was an attractive defendant in this case. She got up on the stand, she started crying and saying how sorry she was, and she went to jail and she wanted to talk to the mother of the defendant, or of the decedent in this case, who has nothing to do with me. I don't have the ability to say, well, you may have gone to jail after you killed my son, but, you know, you didn't get punished for it. I mean, I didn't have that ability to say that because that wasn't my client or wasn't my client's son at the time. I'm simply a third party in this case who wasn't associated with the death, but I had a serious injury. Now, when you juxtapose the serious injuries associated with my client with the death of Mr. Logan, I mean, admittedly, my client's injuries, he's still alive, he's still healthy, he's still going down the road of life. But Mr. Logan, unfortunately, isn't here today. But in the context of the trial, I really didn't have the ability to counteract that because it was so prejudicial to my client. I didn't have the ability to do anything to attack that in this case. As far as, I guess that ties into the other aspect of the testimony itself. It wasn't relevant to my client. He wasn't, Ms. Logan or Ms. Ryan in this case wasn't charged with the crime for my client. The testimony, even if you accept that the plea comes in, the testimony associated with Ms. Logan and feeling sorry for Ms. Logan and all this other testimony had nothing to do with my client. So it was totally irrelevant to my client's case.
Well, help me understand when you said the reason punitive damages should be awarded is because she was driving 80 miles an hour through a red light and caused a death. So you're citing the death as evidence of willful and wanton conduct, and yet you seem to say she shouldn't have been able to talk about the consequences that she paid as a result of the death.
Well, I don't think it's possible to parse out what happened to Mr. Logan and what happened to my client. She was drunk. She was speeding. She ran a red light. My client had neck surgery. He had to witness the death. I don't know how you would parse that out. I mean, I had to testify, I had my client testify that he witnessed the death of Mr. Logan in order to establish his claim for
emotional
distress.
Well, the reason I'm asking
the
question is you said this prejudicial testimony about her remorse for the death was irrelevant to your case and there was nothing you could do about it. And yet, on the other hand, you seem to be saying the death that she caused and the fact that the death was witnessed by your client is relevant. So how do we include one and exclude the other?
Well, what I'm getting at is the testimony, once she's convicted, okay, anything subsequent to that is not relevant to the case, okay? Her feelings of remorse, whether or not she's going to have lunch with Ms. Logan, Ms. Logan tomorrow or next week, I mean, that's the cutoff point wherein relevance would either stop or not start or stop at that point in time. So that's more the point that I'm getting at with regard to that issue with relevance. Okay, other than the argument with regard to prior case law, the relevance really ends with the point that she's convicted. Anything that happened thereafter, how she's doing today, is really not relevant to anything before that. It's not a sentencing hearing. It's not like we can come before the trial judge, and say, look, I'm sorry, don't send me to jail, I wouldn't do it again, those kinds of things. It's a completely
different
context. What
specifically did you ask the trial judge to charge the jury on in regard to punitive damages?
It was, as I recall, it was the standard punitive damage charge in the form instructions. I don't believe that we changed those in any way.
Okay. And what were the elements of the punitive damage claim, as you recall it, from the standard charge?
Willful, wanton conduct on behalf of the defendant, rising to the level that punitive damages would be necessary or would be appropriate to punish a defendant. And the conduct associated with my client, and again, I understand that Mr. Logan, his death in this case is one issue. My client watching that death is another issue. I mean, her being drunk is another issue. Her speeding that fast on 202 is another issue. I mean, they're all, it's very hard to, I didn't feel that I was able to parse those out at trial. I mean, they all came in, they were all part and parcel of one accident. And I did my best to attack those, but that's essentially what I was faced with.
You're in your rebuttal. Did you want to save it?
Yes, Your Honor.
If it pleases the court, I'm Edward Cafeter. I'm here for representing the appellees in this matter. Rather than go through at length the evidence that was presented in this matter, I will shorten that up a little bit and say that I believe in the end what the jury determined is that there wasn't any relationship between the surgery that eventually was performed on Mr. Wilhelm in August of 2003 and the automobile accident in May of 2001. The evidence indicated that Mr. Wilhelm did not have any surgery, any treatment at all for any problems with his neck between August of 2001 and January of 2003. This surgery that was performed was the same surgery that was recommended to him by two different doctors in 1998 after an automobile accident in that year. And I believe the jury concluded that there just wasn't a relationship between the surgery that was performed. We had a Dr. Bennett testify that an MRI scan done in February of 2003 shortly after Mr. Wilhelm woke up with excruciating pain in his right arm and neck was significantly different from earlier MRI scans and that his clinical presentation was different. So I think that's the starting place for the jury's determination about the amount of damages awarded. Basically, they awarded Mr. Wilhelm compensatory damages for 3 months worth of aggravation for his pre-existing neck and right arm problems. And then the issue becomes the punitive damages.
What about the intentional infliction of emotional distress? Was there any charge on that, any evidence on
there
that?
There was a charge on intentional infliction of emotional distress, and there was certainly evidence that could support intentional or negligent infliction of emotional distress award in this case. And with Mr. Wilhelm's testimony, he had watched Mr. Logan bleeding heavily and dying in front of his eyes.
Was his subjective testimony the only evidence?
The evidence on that as well was that he did not consult with any psychologist, counselor, or anyone of that nature for any problems that he claimed in reaction to what he had seen. He did testify that his sleep was interrupted, but had no treatment for it.
All right, so he testified basically that it caused him emotional distress, and the plaintiff basically relied on the intuition of the jury that it would basically cause anybody some emotional distress.
I think that's true.
But there was no independent, objective medical evidence of it.
No, there wasn't. I'll take that back. I think that at least Dr. Vitt said that he had discussed with Mr. Wilhelm the fact that he was having some interruption in his sleep, I think, in the summer of 2001.
Were there any specific interrogatories to the jury where they broke down a damage award, or was it one lump sum damage award?
Lump sum, I think there was a provision for punitive damages, but the compensatory was lump sum.
And would they just say zero for punitive?
Yes. There were a couple of things that the court asked that I just wanted to go over about the punitive damage aspect. The charge on this was the standard charge. It's set out at A25 in the appendix. And the jury was informed that if they found that the defendant had engaged in reckless conduct, which means an I don't care attitude, then they could award punitive damages in this matter, and that the amount of punitive damages should bear a reasonable relationship to, I can't quite pick that out right now, but a reasonable relationship to any award of compensatory damages. So that's the instruction they had. There were not any, there was not any evidence put on of the defendant's net worth. I've tried several cases in which punitive damages were sought, and I cannot recall any in which there was an investigation of the defendant's assets done by the plaintiff's attorney, and that this is usually what happens when you have punitive damages. As a trial attorney, having done this a few times, I can see that it becomes somewhat risky for the plaintiff to ask for punitive damages, because what happened in this case, what may have happened in this case, may well happen in other cases, and that is, if the defendant is sympathetic, it can have an impact on the way everything goes for this trial. I think that's happened here.
Well, you're suggesting that because the testimony that was allowed, in spite of the motion in limine, that allowed the defendant to talk about her remorse and the impact on her of having been involved in this accident, having been criminally punished and having killed someone, would have had a deleterious effect on the compensatory damages?
No, on the punitive damage aspect. I mean, once you put that in, it seems to me that when the defendant gets up and presents, well, you're just not going to get very far with it. It's
Mark,
not
you just meant
punitive damages. If you look at the motions in limine that I had filed before this trial, there's a disposition of them on A5 of various motions in limine that I had filed. Basically, I was making the argument to the court that Mr. Logan's death really had nothing to do with the plaintiff's claim in this matter. There was an amendment of the complaint, though, before trial, to specify a claim for intentional and negligent infliction of emotional distress. I think that's why the court ruled, allowed that in. I had made motions to keep out the fact that my client was convicted of vehicular homicide, and that she, well, and the pictures that were involved in the collision, there were pictures of the Logan vehicle and the my client's vehicle taken after the accident. There were no pictures of the plaintiff's car, though, that were taken after the accident. All those things came in, and I think that has a bearing on how this, why punitive damages, how it was handled in this case, because the jury basically had heard all about, just about every aspect of this matter at the plaintiff's insistence, that the fact that my client had done something that resulted in the death of Mr. Logan, who was not a party, and the damage done to the cars and that sort of thing. During the course of the main investigating police officer's testimony, he testified that my client had pled guilty and had been sentenced to jail already. So in this case, I think that the only thing that the court needs to decide is, given the information that was already before the jury in this matter, was it an abuse of discretion to allow the jury to also hear the sentence that the plaintiff received, given the evidence that was already there? And I think the court can narrowly respond to the appeal in that issue, that this was no abuse of discretion. But to go further on this, I think, given the pronouncements that this court has made in Jardel, that it is appropriate for the jury to consider in and of itself what has happened to the defendant by way of the criminal justice process. There are some pronouncements made by this court, or observations made by this court, on page 529 of Jardel, where there's a discussion of the nature and purpose of an award of punitive damages. And these pronouncements were considered by the trial court in reaching a conclusion about whether to allow testimony on this issue. At page 529, the Jardel Court indicated a majority of jurisdictions now accept the punitive damages serve a dual purpose, to punish wrongdoers and to deter others from similar conduct. And it seems to me that if you're considering that dual purpose, one of the things a jury can consider is, well, what happened with this person criminally? How were they punished? And is it necessary for us, you know, given the punishment that was already extracted, do we feel that it's appropriate for us to impose more punishment by way of a civil penalty, basically? And it seems to me the Jardel Court later on at page 529 seemed to recognize that as a proposition. This is a quote again. The punishment slash deterrence rationale underlying punitive damages has caused them to be characterized as civil penalties, which serve as a substitute for criminal prosecution for conduct, which, though criminal, often goes unpunished by the public prosecutor. And I think that's ties into this idea as well.
I take it there's no restitution element to any criminal sentence that she had imposed.
Not as regards Mr. Wilhelm. I cannot say I remember this for sure. I can't remember whether she was, I'm sure she had to pay court costs, but
I'm not talking about court costs. Yeah. I'm talking about sometimes when insurance doesn't cover the entire damage to someone who's killed or injured in an automobile accident, and there's a corresponding criminal charge, the court has the authority to award restitution even to the insurance carrier.
That did not occur. Okay. Any payment to the insurance, and if there was an award or requirement that she make any restitution, it may have been for property damage or something like that. In any event, I think that this court can, given the evidence that was already presented to the jury in this matter, before my client testified, I think this court can review the judge's determination, the trial judge's determination about whether this should be admitted based on an abuse of discretion. There is also argument as well that's been presented by a plaintiff about whether he should have been entitled to a new trial or additor, and again, that's on review generally by this court on an abuse of discretion basis, and the trial court in considering these matters has been instructed that jury verdict should be given great deference and not disturbed as long as there's some evidence to support the findings of the jury. As I pointed out, there was evidence to support the findings that there was no relationship between the surgery and the automobile accident. And finally, the issue of the award of cost in this matter. I think the trial judge in this matter simply followed the dictates of Rule 68, and again, this would be on an abuse of discretion. He awarded costs to the plaintiff that were incurred before the offer of judgment was made, but after the offer of judgment was made and not taken by the plaintiff, then the plaintiff did not recover costs that were incurred after the date of the offer, and the defendant did recover costs, or at least a portion of the costs that she incurred after the offer of judgment was made.
Do you think there's any conflict between Rule 68 and the statute discussing the circumstances under which a party is to be awarded damages or awarded cost?
Well, that's put in the discretion of the court under Rule 54, correct? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, isn't there a statute
that says
the plaintiff shall be entitled if they get an award to recover their cost?
Yeah, I think there is an inherent conflict between a Rule 54, the statute, but the rules have been enacted later, and I think the preamble of the rules say that the rules take precedence over earlier enacted statutes. I'm not sure, 100% sure about that, but I kind of remember reading that a while ago. I think there may be some. Generally, the courts have followed Rule 68 once an offer has been made. If you're looking at the Greenidge case, it seems to me that Judge Witham engrafted on that some of the provisions of the discretion of the judge on Rule 54 and denied any cost before the offer of judgment was made as well. But this is a very typical action of the judge in cases that I've tried where there's issues regarding cost, is to follow the dictates of Rule 68 pretty much down the line. Costs incurred before go to the plaintiff. If the plaintiff is successful but less successful than the offer of judgment, cost after go to the defendant. Now, again, an abuse of discretion standard here, and I suggest to this court that there was no abuse of discretion in enforcing Rule 68 in this matter. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Briefly, with regard to Rule 68, 54, and 8906, I believe the rules as well as the statute are fairly harmonious with one another. 8906 and Rule 54 allow a successful plaintiff in a case to recover costs and witness fees. I was, even though I received $4,108 in this case, I was the successful party. Therefore, under the statute, I should be entitled to costs and fees without reduction. Rule 68 indicates that in the event that the offer of judgment or the actual verdict is less than the offer of judgment, then the defense in this case is entitled to their costs. So I think when you take all three of the rules and statute together, I believe they're completely harmonious with one another in that if I'm successful, I get my costs and fees. If they're successful under Rule 68, they get their costs and fees. I don't know how there's some form of an equitable
offer. How would the offer of judgment rule make any sense if you were to prevail in that?
Well, the offer of judgment rule says that in the event that the actual verdict is less than the offer of judgment, then they get their costs. It doesn't say that I'm not allowed to recover my costs under 54 or 8906. So I believe the way you look at it logically is if I'm successful but less than the offer of judgment, we both get our costs. So I believe that's how the rules as well as the statute should be harmonized in this case. With regard to Jardel, Your Honor, as I pointed out in my reply brief, the issue in Jardel isn't the issue before the court here today. Jardel didn't have the issue of whether or not evidence of a conviction and subsequent testimony is admissible in a civil trial to mitigate damages. The issue in that case was different. It was whether or not the punitive damages would even come into this case. So the language referred to by counsel in this case wasn't the holding in the case. It wasn't the issue in the case, and it was simply dicta on the part of the court. But notwithstanding that, even the rationale associated with the dicta, the main language that counsel relies upon is punitive damages are a substitute often for damages, often not punished by the prosecutor in this case. Well, that doesn't mean to the exclusion of having them in a civil trial. In other words, if you change the facts in this case just a little bit, let's assume that this lady, Miss Ryan, wasn't speeding in this case, or was just speeding. She wasn't drunk. She did run a red light. She did still kill Mr. Logan. My client still did have the injuries in this case associated with the surgery. The activity wouldn't rise to the level of punitive damages in a civil context. However, she still could be charged for breach of the public peace under the criminal statutes. So I believe that you have to look at it in that context in order to establish whether or not punitive damages could or should be awarded in the civil case. With regard to, I can't emphasize this enough to the court. In a civil trial, in the context of this trial, we had my client testified, there were the injuries, there was the death, and as far as the prejudice is concerned, I can't convey to the court how a 17-year-old girl, attractive, wearing a skirt and an ankle bracelet, her getting on the stand, crying, telling about the mother of the decedent in this case, influenced the jury. Now, I know counsel in this case wants to indicate that that's, you know, somehow what happened to the non-award of punitive damages in this case, but I can't convey enough to the court, unless you were there, how it affected the credibility of the compensatory claim in this case. I don't know how a jury, if you look at the jury and they're saying whether or not Mr. Wilhelm and his injuries and whether or not we believe his testimony and his credibility associated with his neck surgery, with her having that testimony, that prejudicial testimony, I can't explain or convey to the court how that affected the outcome in this case. And I pointed out in my brief It's not just my opinion in this case. It was Mr. Gefeder's opinion at the time of post-trial motions, but also the trial court. I put in my brief the notes of test or the argument associated with post-trial motions and what the court actually thought of the testimony and it being surprised as to the award in this case, as well as Mr. Wilhelm. So as far as the effect of the testimony that historically hasn't been allowed here in Delaware, the effect it had on this case, I can't convey enough to the court. You simply had to be there to feel it and see it. Therefore, I believe it was an abuse of discretion for the court to even entertain that kind of testimony and its effect on the court, on the jury. And I don't know how the court would go about parsing out, all right, if we found that the court did abuse its discretion and somehow affected the outcome of this case. I don't know how the court can properly come back and fashion an award that would say, okay, this would properly do what the jury could have, should have, would have done at the time had this testimony not been admitted at the time of trial.
So before you sit down, tell us what should be excluded. In other words, you would let her say, I was convicted. You would not let her say, I went to jail. You would not let her say, I'm sorry, or just simply, I was convicted.
I don't believe her testimony at all is relevant in this case. All the facts necessary for my case were admitted. They were all put into the record prior to her testimony. I don't believe that any of her testimony, if there were a retrial, I don't believe she should be allowed to testify whatsoever.
But if your theory is you want the jury to punish her,
mm-hmm.
what, if anything, can she say about, I've already been punished, here's how? Is she allowed to say anything?
No. Historically, the courts have not allowed evidence of a criminal conviction to come in to mitigate a civil damage award or punitive damages in a civil case.
That's not directly responsive, I think, to Justice Holland's question. His question is, put aside her repeating the fact in a case where liability wasn't an issue, that she had entered a plea of guilty and had been sentenced to vehicular homicide.
Mm-hmm.
His question is, what else would she have been able to testify to about the impact of having gone through all this on her and how it punished her?
I don't believe that she'd be able to testify to any of that, because this isn't a criminal sentencing hearing. This is a civil damages hearing, and since all the facts in the case were admitted, any testimony from her on that were stipulated to by the defense in this case. Any of her testimony associated with that, it's not necessary.
But you want punitive damages to punish her. Does that mean she can't talk in any way about how she has already been punished by her experience, even when she should arguably have an opportunity to respond to a claim that she intentionally inflicted emotional distress on your client? How does she respond to, I didn't intend it to happen? Or does she even get to testify to that?
In the facts in this particular case, all the facts were stipulated to prior to trial. Therefore, I don't believe her testimony would be necessary. In the event that none of those facts are stipulated to in the context of this trial, might be different. But all the facts necessary to my claims were stipulated to prior to trial, and the jury could have found an award just simply based upon that.
All right, you had a claim for punitive damages. What facts were stipulated to that relate to punitive damages?
Speeding, drunk, killed.
And that's it? The person doesn't get to testify about the potential economic impact on her of paying punitive damages, or the extent to which she had already been punished but would be punished additionally by an award of damages, or anything related to, as I think you put it, how she, quote, felt, close quote, about the accident?
None
of that's relevant.
Your Honor, I don't believe so, and I understand. I think if you were to look at the Jefferson case that was decided as to why a defendant would not be allowed to testify to those particular facts in this case, being a different, public versus private, different parties in this case. Maybe there was a plea.
Is that the 1858 or the 1989 case?
I believe it was the 1845, Your Honor.
That was a Superior Court case, wasn't it?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. When I was entered into the bar of this court, they gave me a book about the history of the bar of the court, and I never thought I'd have a need for that, but I actually had to go back into that book to understand how this court was structured way back when. And it's my understanding, and I'm still confused, and I tried my best last night to figure this out, it's my understanding that initially the Supreme Court, the Superior Court was the Supreme Court, and it rode in circuit. And I don't know that the formal Supreme Court was established back in 1845 such that would be a Superior Court opinion as we understand it today, being a trial court versus a appellate court. I simply don't understand.
There's an article on our website you could look at about the leftover judge system, and it explains how all that works.
I tried my best, Your Honor, but I did open the book, and all the dust flew up, but it was an
There's
interesting read.
There's less dust on the website.
Oh.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.